Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Otto Sommerez-Smith. Otto is assistant professor at Warwick University and is the author of a fascinating book entitled Boom Cities, Architect Planners and the Politics of Radical Urban Renewal in 1960s Britain. Otto, welcome to City Talks.
Thank you.
So you describe yourself as an architectural historian. Just for the listeners and indeed for myself, just tell us what an architectural historian is and I suppose the implications of that as an approach to look at and think about cities, and then that'll tee us up, I think, for the book itself.
Yeah, of course. So I suppose when most people think of architectural historians, they think of, you know, tweed jacket and country houses. Not on a sunny day like today, I do own a tweed jacket, but, you know, I'm interested in the everyday built environment of post-war Britain. So unusual subjects, I think, for most architectural historians. I'm interested in shopping centres and car parks and pedestrian precincts and leisure centres and places that I think don't get looked at very often. But I think the everyday built environment of Britain is a great place to see how to try and track some of the huge changes that happened to Britain in the post-war period, because it's the place where you can see, you know, abstract concepts, whether it's social polarisation or deindustrialisation or gentrification or the welfare state. These concepts, which I think are often talked about in very abstract terms, that's, you know, in cities they're made manifest, they're made concrete.
Yeah, you could say. And so it's the interplay between which is part of the kind of framing of the book, the interplay between, you know, the built environment, the architectural form, and then, you know, the social, economic, political, cultural issues and trends and patterns that are playing out at any given moment.
Absolutely. I think so often, especially the 1960s architecture has been explained solely through the architectural idea of modernism. But I'm really interested in the way that architectural ideas gain traction with other kinds of decision makers and policy makers, whether politicians, civil servants, developers, and what modernism solutions meant to them. So I think those kinds of planning ideals only gain traction within the people who could actually enact them because they spoke to broader political worries about which were widespread within the entire society, rather than just the small interest of a small coterie of sort of sinister architects and planners.
And in the book, which we are you highlight how, you know, concepts or notions of modernity and modernism are, it can be interpreted, you know, from the left of the political agenda and indeed from the right of the political agenda, and depending on which one is looking at it, you know, they take different aspects of that, you know, the notion and the concept.
Yes, I suppose one of the things that is unusual in my account is really saying that this is a moment, so the early 1960s, when this particular brand of very radical approaches to cities happened. I think it's often there's a long-held association of modernism with the left. I think it often came out that, especially on the new right in the 1970s, there was an attempt to say that urban planning had been an example of the failure of state planning per se. And Thatcher is very adept at saying, you know, that she's going to fight against the block mentality, the tower block, block schools, block votes, and these things are all put together. But so this means this long ingrained association of modernism with the left means that actually the conservative embrace in the 1960s of modernism it has been forgotten. So a large part of one of the chapters is showing how modernist ideas could give expression to many ideas of the right, which was partly, you know, in part because a lot of them had connections with the construction industry. Someone like Ernest Marples was the Minister of Transport and Director of Marples Ridgeway, who got the contract for the Hammersmith flyover. Yes. So and Keith Joseph, who is someone who, you know, later he says he congratulates Michael Heseltine on becoming head of the Department of the Environment, and he says, "Oh, good luck in your new job. You'll find lots of problems. I caused most of them." And you know, so he later disavows urban modernism, but at the time he is a huge advocate for it, and
he's
a big advocate for it. And so there is a modernism in this period of the welfare state, of housing and schools, and there is also a modernism of developers and shopping centres.
Yes.
And these ideas could be taken on by both left and right,
and they were, and we'll come on to that. So take us back. You write about the 1960s and the sort of period that, you know, that was. Take us back to, I suppose, you know, talk a little bit about how you think about and how you lay out in the book, you know, Britain at the end of the 1950s, or indeed as we arrive in the 1960s. What's Britain like? What's on its mind? You know, what's the politics of the moment? What is the, you know, what are the politicians worried about, or, you know, excited about?
So, I mean, I think it is a very particular moment, and one of the main things which is driving the political, the thought world of politics is an idea of economic optimism. There's a general feeling that economic problems have been solved, and a presumption that people are going to get richer and richer, and that the affluent society has arrived. And this is with the arrival of television, consumer goods, more types of housing, and there's a presumption that political problems are going to be resolved on the back of ever increasing economy.
Yeah.
One of the big sides of this is the arrival of mass automobile usage.
Indeed. Cars.
And cars have really arrived at this point. And there's an important report, which is a big theme throughout the book.
Indeed.
Is this Colin Buchanan's Traffic
Seminar
in Town.
1963. Traffic in towns.
Traffic in
towns. Well known to all of us and everyone who's remotely engaged in, in urban planning, urban politics, urban economics.
Yeah, and Buchanan actually has a rather nuanced idea of the car, and he presents this problem that if you're going to have full use of cars in cities, the way cities are at the moment just won't work, and you'll have to completely rebuild them.
Yes,
I think people could read the Buchanan report, set out like a civil service paper. He complained vociferously that people just looked at the main image of Fitzrovia with a dizzying on dizzying multiple levels, and it was something of a reductio ad absurdum.
Yeah.
So the Buchanan report has two trajectories from of it. One of which is to actually is part of movements to stop cars and think more carefully about the heritage of cathedral cities, But it also gives added energy to what a lot of architect planners have been saying about the complete total reconstruction of cities.
And just to back up a second,
you
talked a little bit about, and you highlighted, you know, this sort of change, this affluent society, you know, the rapid expansion of, you know, consumer goods in the consumption part of the economy, but also in a sense that cars, they became symbols of an affluent society. They became symbols of kind of liberty and freedom, people being able to jump in their car and, you know, get wherever they wanted to go. So it wasn't just simply a mode of moving from one place to the next or from one location. You know, my sense is that, you know, the cars had a symbolic role. And so when we then thought about the role of cars in our city's context, it became more difficult, more challenging to say maybe they shouldn't be incorporated in quite the way that they is. That, do you think, is that what you're
yes.
suggesting as well?
Yeah.
Would you agree with that, do you think?
I mean, before the oil crisis, it was very rare to see cars as anything but a symbol of spreading prosperity.
Mm.
And I mean, and certainly socialist figures could say, you know, there's much less, I think it's either Roy Jenkins or Tony Crossland has an argument about there's much less difference between someone in a Morris Minor and a Rolls Royce than someone in a Morris Minor and on the pavement,
we're
being splashed. So there is an idea that this you know, even in cities where car ownership was way below average,
yes,
this expands the ordinary person's life opportunities hugely, and it's only with the it takes a long time for people to start talking, especially in central government, that some types of people will never be able to
and
no talk about children, no talk about the disabled,
they get forgotten. So we've got sort of the emergence of the car in a functional sense, but also in a symbolic sense, this kind of affluent society. Just give us, paint a picture of how, you know, again, how the broader question about how are cities seen, and particularly how are the city centres of our city seen in that context of increasing affluence, consumer goods, so just paint the picture as to where they were, and then we'll get into some of the detail, asking you to talk a little bit more about, because you do some case studies on Blackburn, which were fascinating, and Liverpool, which was brilliant. But just give us a bigger picture about, you know, were city centres already identified as problematic, or were they opportunities, or were they no longer relevant? I mean, what was the perception and perspective at the time?
Of course, so one of the things I try and is that I try and capture the different types of cities, and this could be. True of, but one of the main places, I mean, where radical renewal happens at its most extreme form is in the Victorian cities of the Industrial Revolution. And I think generally we have told the history, the urban history of Britain, through the new towns or places like Coventry and mostly London.
Yes.
And there's a presumption that those existing cities were products of the 19th century and then stopped.
Yeah.
So I think I'm one of a number of people in this book saying that actually these cities are places. So Blackburn is one of them, but
yes.
Bolton, especially Bradford, places that are already experiencing the tremors of deindustrialization. I think there's a huge shame in local government about, I mean, people who come into politics in the 1960s, in the post-war period, will have a feeling that their role is to undo some of the damages of the Victorian city.
Mm.
So the Victorian architecture of these places has huge symbolic weight.
Yes.
I think also before the Clean Air Act is felt, these places are dirty, grimy, embarrassing. In many ways, the architects and planners can be more sympathetic about the qualities of Victorian architecture. But I think for many people, they're an embarrassment. The mayor of Blackburn says, you know, Blackburn needs to put some war paint on if it's going to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
They've had industrialists come to the city and have got on the next
train
out
because they're
turned away.
The feel of the place.
So there's an embarrassment. There's an embarrassment about these cities. But every type of city feels this pressure about the car. And I mean also about the other pressure is about shopping, and the multiples are coming in.
Yes.
and new supermarkets and new big urban forms that affluence and the car need.
Yes.
Of supermarkets, of car parks, of roads, which just completely changes the scale of how cities are thought.
Yes.
So there is a presumption that, to return to Ernest Marples, who says the way we have been building cities with a road, a pavement, and a building, the way we've been building since the Roman period is out of date. We've got to completely rethink the way we build cities.
Yeah.
And I suppose there are two ways the shopping centres come in two forms of pedestrian precincts and then new forms of multi-level circulation. So building the city on a deck on top of the car.
And so both of those ideas take as their assumption that the car has to be incorporated into the city centre.
Yes.
And therefore there is a separation challenge, which is how do you both incorporate the car where it's previously not been incorporated, at least not in the same way, and maintain, I guess, safety with in relation to pedestrians and experiences. So those are the kind of two ways. So just outline a little bit more, because I'm fascinated by, at no point, at least in the book, do you suggest, or is it suggested, that no one asked the question, should we incorporate the car? Or Buchanan kind of took it as read that, we're having mass car ownership, they need to be able to get these cars into cities, then it becomes the challenge about how do we do that effectively and efficiently and safely, rather than asking a more basic question, which is, should we enable the car to come right into the city centres in the scale and volume that was envisaged? But what's your take on that? Am I misreading that in sort of Buchanan's work or in your view of it or not?
I think, I mean, Buchanan says either you restrict the car or you rebuild cities. Those are your two options.
Yeah.
And he gives various shades of those.
Yeah.
I think because it's a civil service report, he can be equivocal about it.
Yeah.
And he's upset when money isn't made, when Barbara Castle meets him in the next government and she describes him as a shy, rather dedicated person.
Yes.
And he doesn't understand why money isn't being made made available.
Yeah.
And so when the money doesn't come, I think the Buchanan report does have the answer within it, which is different types of restriction. I think, and the other thing is that's extraordinary about is the number of road deaths is just, which have gone down because we have, we've restricted the way pedestrians are able to use the city.
Yeah.
And I mean, so there's a story after this moment of radical renewal, this brief moment where I think there is a feeling that we might go with this option of completely rebuilding cities for the car. There are other types of, more banal, small scale restrictions. But as with any types of, it's been a political impossibility to restrict the car completely.
Yeah.
But this, and I think the other problem was that the types of architecture created by the car didn't always create places which were nice to be in. I don't mind a pedestrian precinct can be a nice thing, but it pushes all of the traffic mess outside of that place. And if you go to the back side of Stevenage or Coventry,
yeah.
the place where the bins are,
mm-hmm.
and where car parking is, and the scale of what a car park is difficult to love.
Yeah.
Buchanan talked of the big shopping centres later in the 1970s, and even he said, you know, I going around the country, each one depresses me, but the sort of the tackiness and the stickers and the...
Yeah.
That feeling that, because I suppose one of the themes of the book is that we've got an idea about modernism versus sort of other types of values, but a lot of the architectural values are said through trying to get back to, it can be rather conservative, trying to get back to a rather socially old way of how cities work. You know, they are interested in, you know, the pedestrian experience, and it's the word urbanity that is this sort of catchphrase for them, which sort of I think is, you know, bringing modernism into line with an ideal of 18th century sort of politesse, and it's so that and it's so a lot of the plans work through the visual tropes of the townscape movement, which is very interested in seeing the city through a sort of series of images. So you know, you and old buildings are contextualized, and the planners talk about, you know, moments of surprise and seeing cities as a you know, almost a theatrical townscape.
Yes, kind of visual, the visual experience is a dominant kind of theme in that sort of idea, isn't it? In a sense that it's about how you lay out and set up the next vision or the next visage as you come.
But it's extremely difficult to square with what cars are doing to cities, and what other, you know, other things like industrialized building techniques and just the scale of development which is needed.
So the other connection you make in the book, particularly early on, is the connection between, you know, these kind of aspirations of the political class to reposition or to position Britain, you know, in the white heat, you know, at the frontier of technology, you know, an economic powerhouse, as it were, you know, coming out of, you know, difficult periods in the 50s on, you know, on the back of the Second World War. So, and then, you know, so the redevelopment of the city centre takes on, you know, a kind of manifestation of those broader aspirations. Say a little bit about that and how that then played out and what that meant for the view and the vision of city centres in that sort of, in that broader context.
Well, in some ways, I think I'm pushing a history which is very familiar now and an idea which is still about the longer history of deindustrialisation. Mm. It's certainly in a city like Blackburn, it's felt in the early 1960s. This is a moment of uneasy optimism for provincial Britain, and I think there is there's an understanding that there are going to be huge rapid changes, and that this can be harnessed to completely change. But it's a funny, and it remains an awkward, I think, where the money comes for these transformations always remains ambiguous.
Yes.
Unless it's from developers and the private sector. And actually a shopping centre is not a very useful, is not necessarily a solvable for a city which is seeing the rapid decline of its primary industry.
Indeed not.
But it is something that I think political classes can be shown to be being productive without any of their own money.
Mm. It sort of answers the call of, you know, something must be done. Here's something very big and very visible, and we can point to it and say, here is the thing that has been done.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't solve or even begin to resolve the actual underlying nature of the issue. Unfortunately, you know, we see that again, you know, in modern times, don't we? Since the solution that's offered doesn't really relate or reflect
to the problem as we understand them. So if those things don't change, I think that's right. Talk a little bit about Blackburn and sort of make real, I suppose, some of the things, you know, the kind of theme. Just give us a sort of potted history of how these kind of bigger things and bigger trends and thoughts and the car and pedestrianisation and stilting and all. How did that play out in a place like Blackburn, which was, as you know, textile town, you know, grew big on, in the Industrial Revolution, you know, significant. But then by the time we get to the 1960s, it's gone through some, you know, several rounds of hard times, as it were.
Yeah. So I came to Blackburn. One of the things which was odd about researching this book is that, you know, I went into lots of local authority record offices. I'd read these plans, in the library, and then you go and you try and find the decision making behind a plan, and you bring out the council book, and you go down, and it will say 4th of June, 1963, plan approved, and that's all you hear about this thing, apart from the glass and steel and concrete buildings around the around the city. Blackburn was controversial, and central government with their bigger record keeping took note. It was a cotton. It was, you know, a big cotton place, and already there is a feeling that they need to change the economy to other types of manufacturing. And there's a shame about the Victorian architecture of the city. So, you know, the Blackburn's councillor, he says, we're going to have the courage to knock down our entire centre and rebuild it within modern means. It was and they worked with Lang as the developer, and the architects were Building Design Partnership, actually a firm.
Still in existence, aren't they?
They're still in existence and were doing wonderful work in the 1960s, including the listed Preston bus station, which is a thing of very great beauty.
Indeed.
And
wow, you know,
the Halifax headquarters building, I don't know if you know, which is a glorious thing.
Right.
And I think the shopping centre is no longer there. So the BDP one, I mean, there are bits of it. It had a 90s recladding. But I think, you know, it was a cut above. Ian Nairn said it had a very great style, an industrial north style, a canal style. I talked to the developer behind the new shopping centre scheme, and so the original, the 1960s shopping centre had demolished this market hall with a clock. Fine bit of restrained Victorian classicism, but the new shopping centre had this new clock, a rather wonderful sort of constructivist thing, which has now gone. And the developer assured me that the new Blackburn shopping centre would also have a clock, which means that in half a century this city has had three. clock towers representing the civic continuity of the city.
Yes.
So there was a lot to be. I think it was in its way a rather wonderful thing, the shopping centre. But the people, I mean, because it takes one of the things that's so surprising about the early 1960s is that the widespread public opposition to planning was rarely there, but the people that you did hear the voice of was the small shopkeepers,
yes,
who were already who were going to be turfed out.
I think in the book you say, well, that you got, out of 388 existing shops in the town centre, the scheme would involve the demolition of 251.
Yeah,
and essentially lots of local shopkeepers, often, you know, just having their, you know, one unit, as it were going to be replaced by, you know, multiples paying extraordinarily higher rent as a result of the redevelopment, which plays into a whole, you know, whole load of different issues there, doesn't
it? I think one of the surprising is these types of local shopkeepers are small C conservative,
yeah,
and they're ignored by their natural allies in central government.
Yes.
So when Keith Joseph receives a deputation, he says, you know, no, we can't stop progress like this.
Yeah.
But it was part of the, you know, they were part of the civic life of the city. And I think when the inner city crisis happens and there's a sudden realization of the lack of jobs, I think one of the reasons was often thought for the huge unemployment is these types of small businesses which were being turfed out,
mm-hmm,
and so when suddenly the economy really falters, there's a feeling that the processes of urban renewal had got rid of these kinds of economies, and actually small-scale economics, which these cities had survived on, so that but it was very, very extreme what,
yes,
happened in Blackburn, and so it was a but I think indicative of what was happening all around the country.
Yeah. How much of the grand vision or the grand plan for Blackburn actually was built out? I mean, in a sense, if you look at some of the images in the book, which are, I mean, depending on whether you're, you know, excited or, you know, I mean, I'm scared stiff looking at some of those sorts of things, thinking, oh my God. But how much in Blackburn was actually realised in terms of the entirety of the redevelopment plan?
A lot. I mean, an unusual amount.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the plans that I've talked on here are, but you know, but Blackburn is unusually robust at it, and
yeah.
I mean, had they not now demolished it again, you know, this might have been one day appreciated and seen as an
example. Why was it that Blackburn, you know, did more, you know, did almost all of their plan, which makes it out to be accepted? I mean, what was there?
They got going
a combination of politics and, you know, financials, and you know, what was it that
they got going? They got going early, but I mean, what it means now is that because the city centre of Blackburn is basically a shopping centre.
Yes.
It's a very peculiar. I did a bit of stuff with the Farrell Review about the urban room with this place, and it's a peculiar place. It's got in that I think it's got a population of 180,000, so it's now, and actually in the context of the region, it's doing okay economically now, and that there are types of manufacturing, and
there is some manufacturing, but mainly in the suburbs and on the skirts.
But the city centre, you can't stay. There isn't a hotel.
No.
You have to go to Preston, and there isn't really, you know, there isn't really a restaurant. And
no.
After 5 o'clock,
it's dead.
It's really dead.
Yeah.
And there were other, you know, there's a longer history for that. But part of that is you know, they demolished the types of places that
could
be inhabited like that.
Exactly, and in some respects, you know, places like that, amongst others. I mean, our research, you know, shows this quite clearly. You know, they essentially became almost exclusively retail or shopping destinations, which was fine for a time, but obviously in more recent period now, that has now created a whole set of problems for them as retail and shopping declines, both in a relative sense but also in an absolute sense. And so the question again becomes, you know, what's the role of the city centre in a place like Blackburn or Liverpool or where else? And the answer is not just a place where you go shopping. And in fact, the role of retail in many of these places will shrink quite significantly over time relative to things like residential, again, you know, to cultural and educational facilities, and indeed, you know, non-retail jobs will probably have to come back, all of which, in varying respects, was the stuff that was, you know, booted out in the 60s, as we went down this kind of, you know, monolithic shopping centre approach, which I find, you know, that in itself I find fascinating. That, you know, you can just see decisions made there and the long play of these things, how they play out.
Yeah, and I mean it's privatizing the city centre.
Yeah.
I mean one of the things I sort of want to say about the, because I do, you know, I think that is that it's the problem with this shopping centre isn't about the fact it's got a flat roof. You know, BDP went on to do rather postmodernist shopping centres with sort of different types. But they share the same problems, which are about scale and privatising the city centre. But I understand the fear of those local authority figures in the 1960s, and especially they see that unemployment is coming.
Yeah.
And they have very blunt tools with which to use against it.
In the book, you put two wonderful quotes by Keith Scott, who's the lead architect of Blackburn, and he's basically given a sort of fairly candid description of. In the first quote, he's talking about, you know, his view of labour councillors and the fact that they are, you know, they're big on grand visions and not so good on the detail.
Yeah.
And then, you know, on the next page, you talk a little bit about his view on the Conservative councillors, in the sense that because they are often shopkeepers, for example, they're very, very good on the detail and the specific, but not very good on the grand vision and the strategy. And you have these sort of two slightly obviously different views of, you know, from the different political persuasions kind of playing out in, you know, in thinking about and talking about the future of Blackburn, which I think is fascinating. There's two great quotes in the book, the way he perfectly encapsulates it. I don't know how accurate it was, but it's a wonderful encapsulation.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, one wants to understand is what modernism meant to these people.
Yeah.
And they have an idea. They're terribly worried about people leaving. And they want to attract graduates, and they want to attract graduates and young people.
Yeah.
And you know, it's an aging population, and they think retail and shopping and certain types is the way to do that.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about what happens in, or what did or didn't happen in Liverpool, which I suppose, in part because of Liverpool's history. You know, it has a much larger prominence on the national, you know, scale, and so, you know, has more of a focus, and therefore more people commenting for the good and for the bad about some of the plans. But just say a little bit about, you know, what those visions were for, you know, for Liverpool, and who was advocating these sorts of things. Because it's given a rather unkind name in terms of you know, the gentleman that's responsible for Liverpool. Right?
So Liverpool was planned by a planner called Graham Shankland. That he was brought in 1962 as a consultant for the city centre. He's had a bad reputation. Raphael Samuel called him the butcher of Liverpool.
The butcher of Liverpool.
Simon Jenkins said he was worse than Bomber Harris.
It's not like Simon Jenkins to be, you know.
Well, actually, Simon Jenkins says that seeing the Liverpool plan was what got him interested in architecture.
Oh, really?
He was so horrified by it.
Yeah.
Shankland is a much more complicated, interesting figure than this. And his plan, I think, was overbeholden to the car, but also has all of these features. I find if one's going to talk in the categories of, you know, modernist and postmodernist ideas of the city, he looks schizophrenic. He looks at, you know, the plan does both.
Yes.
I like him because, you know, there's a genuine love of Liverpool. He says, you know, the it's better than Venice. He commissions Quentin Hughes to write a book, which is called Seaport. He's got this high buildings policy with Walter Bohr, which would make a shame of what's happened to Liverpool's high building policy now. It's a sensitive thing. He adores Liverpool. Liverpool is going through a moment, you know, there's a Ian Nan goes and he's upset, you know, and it's the Mersey Sound, it's the Beatles, the football teams are in the, and there's a this whole moment of possibility in Liverpool, you know, this is a very great city which has had it kicked out of it. Nothing had really happened in the post-Blitz period, unlike there had been very little reconstruction. It was described, I think, in the Times as like a sort of mangy bear with sort of with bits coming out of it, and
yeah.
And Shankland, so Shankland loves Liverpool, and he does this plan of astonishing ambition with these huge sites, including a civic centre, which is designed by Colin St. John Wilson. There's a thing on the site which is now Liverpool One, which doesn't, I mean, the civic centre doesn't get built, but which is sort of like the, it's going to be like the Barbican with this huge shopping centre and with towers coming out of it, and the only bit to get built in a shoddy and is the St. John's Precinct, which is a little loved building.
Indeed.
Although I quite like Radio Master. I think we've got a picture of it a bit over here.
Yes. Yeah.
But this is. You know, and he's, it's going to be the biggest pedestrian precinct outside Venice, and it's incredibly ambitious.
But also, he has big, significant prominence to the car, though, doesn't he?
Well, hugely.
In pedestrianisation, but encircled by.
Well, and there's a.
For want of a better way of describing them.
There's a disagreement between him and Bohr about, and that he it's an 8-lane. Ring road. Rainer Banham says about the plan, you know, it starts with a proposition that the point of cars is to move and fast, and there are these extraordinary, there's an extraordinary lack of insight into what that does to cities.
Yes.
Gordon Cullen, the townscape, is brought on as the townscape advisor, and he draws this image of what it would look like under the motorway, which is made to look like, you know, Burlington Arcade, with sort of pubs and shops and people promenading, and which often happens at this period, that there's a real, and you know, that he's lyrical about the car, about the motorway. I think the generous radii and sort of curving loops, and there's a feeling that this is going to be a theatrical thing driving through it.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing that happens in the broader plan is that, you know, so when he says, he talks about the old buildings of Liverpool and says, you know, that heritage is the soul of the city, and, you know, and I think he does predict, you can see he predicts in the plan that Liverpool might have a future in tourism and the arts, and there's a lot about this, and there is that actually, you know, we've got things to celebrate and people should come to Liverpool like they come to Florence, which I think is quite an extraordinary thing to say in the 1960s.
Yes.
And, you know, very predictive. But what he can't see is the possible value of the everyday built environment of, you know, what he just sees as slums. And it means that there is a gigantic slum clearance project in Liverpool, which, and there's huge amounts of demolition for the Ring Road, and then rebuilding goes badly out of step, and it's got more dead land in Liverpool than anywhere in Europe. You know, people come, that it feels like it's been bombed, is what they say. You know, and how depressing those and what happens to with planning blight when you have plans.
Absolutely.
Like this. And so when, and you know, the docks would then close,
compounds the problem.
Which compounds the problem.
Makes it more difficult to maintain the momentum around change and, you know, reallocation of land and activities to come in and take up a lot of that, you know, that space which has been half cleared or partly cleared.
So I mean, Liverpool, I get off the train. I was there recently and I feel a foot taller. It's sort of, I just love that.
It's a fantastic city, but you do get a sense in Liverpool that there is an awful, that still today, there is a lot of infrastructure relative to per person. You cannot miss the amount of, you know, land given over to the car, for example. I think it's noticeable in a place like that much more than.
But the other thing, Shankland's problem is that he didn't have mechanics for implementing the stuff he wanted because he needed private development, and when the money didn't
come,
nothing happened. So, actually, you know, not a huge amount of, you know, the big losses in it, Liverpool architectural heritage, happened earlier. But, you know, the fact that, you know, there was a huge plan for the site of Liverpool One, which then took, 50 years to happen.
So
implementation was
a challenge, yes.
And also, I think especially when the economic predictions don't happen, these things are realised, if at all, in a vulgarised and diluted way.
And so I think that touches on one of the sort of themes through the book, really, is that, you know, you're talking about the 1960s period, and, you know, in a sense, the first half of the 1960s is optimism. It's a kind of forward looking, it's large, it's comprehensive, you know, there's stuff to be done. And then the sort of second half of the 60s, it's almost as if sort of reality comes crashing back in and says, okay, you know, so firstly, I think optimism begins to wane and the economy is not as performing as well as others, which causes concerns for politicians. The money that is needed, either from the public or from the private, doesn't quite materialise in the way. And you have this kind of shift from radicalism to, you know, to pragmatism, which you brilliantly pick up in the book. And actually you show, like, people like Buchanan, by the sort of second half of the 60s and certainly into the 70s, he's much more of a kind of pragmatist, much more of a tinkerer, you know, much more of a make do and mend type perspective than maybe what he was and what others were in the early 60s. I mean, I think there are a number of things going on.
Well, I think, you know, that this moment is a very brief one, and that's of this type of modernism, and the belief, not just by architects, but by, you know, every civil servants and, you know, people in suits and conservative politicians, is based on this economic, and, you know, even in the 1966 Labour manifesto, they said, you know, that we made lots of promises, the Conservatives made lots of promises, the economy can't expand in this way. It's not so much, I mean, these things are made really impossible to ignore by the 1973 oil crisis, which really does. There's a Douglas Hurd book called The End of Promises, and this, I think, you know, in this moment,
this is it,
does really change things. Peter Shaw says, you know, the party's over. But my reading of it pushes this back further, and actually I think that kind of optimism goes quicker. But then the other argument in this is, I think so much of when we talk about what happened to modernist approaches to the built environment is often told through a narrative of the, you know, David and Goliath of the plucky conservation movement versus the Goliath of the modernist establishment. But one of the changes the book tracks is the way that actually individual modernists were also able to change their ideas. And so one of the when the inner city crisis happens, and this becomes one of the big political problems, and which necessitates, it's thought, a shift from dispersal in new towns to actually thinking a bit more about poverty and those left behind. The big government reports are the inner area studies are written by the same people. They're written by Shanklin Cox, they're written by Wilson Womersley, and they're written by Llewellyn Davis, which shows that the modernist establishment, well, those types of elites, you know, weren't set. That's one of the, I think, the big themes of the book. Jane Jacobs wrote about, you know, architects and planners, that they were just enacting things which were blueprints from when they were still children. Mm-hmm. That Corbusier is the only, is that their ideas about traffic and about, but actually these are actors able to change their ideas. So a lot of the disavowal of urban modernism actually comes from within as well as from without.
Not just without,
And I think, you know, just and generally, you know, we begin to see a kicking back against the very supposition that economic benefit, economic growth is a good thing. E.J. Mission's book, The Cost of Economic Growth, I think it's interesting for starting a thing of seeing, you know, the built environment as the example of why the costs of economic growth are not thought about, and that is, you know, an early sign of the environmental movement. And then modernism, I think, becomes a proxy for so much of that whole period. So there are many ways in which the moment ends, but I think the first sign of it is a purely economic one. But then, you know, then a lot more cultural shifts happen.
Yeah.
But it happens within as well as without.
And so when we get towards the end of the 1960s and the sort of period the book is focused on, Otto, I mean, how many places have been kind of dramatically changed? I mean, physically, how many have gone through this, you know, or how many have gone through a process to varying degrees of, you know, significance? But, you know, has this movement touched all, you know, many, many, many places, or actually in reality, lots of plans drawn up, few of them actually enacted, and only very few of them enacted in a comprehensive way? Just give us a scale of it.
I don't think any city escaped the pressures. And they played out in different ways, whether it's, you know, so nowhere didn't have it. And I mean, one, you know, you've been to cities, you walk around and you see this stuff, there it is. I think, you know, but the cities that were most harmed by it were actually ones which didn't have planners involved. I think that, you know, this could happen without planning. Worcester, the cathedral city, which was didn't want to be seen as a museum piece because it was also an industrial place, had a terrible scheme, which is still there, right next to the cathedral, involved the demolition of lots of medieval houses, which they knocked the gutters and took tiles off the roof to give an excuse to demolish them. They demolished the medieval lich gate. This thing is right up against the right up against the cathedral, and so my people, like, so Lionel Brett is one of the people I write about, who's an architect planner, becomes very disillusioned by he says, you know, this is what we asked for, but we hate it. You know, this is grim. You know, this is basically what we asked for, but it's been co-opted by developers. I think, you know, I'm interested.
Are you sympathetic
to
that, or is that just looking for it's the non-realization of the grand plan in the way that it was originally envisaged, and then, you know, in retrospect, it's like,
I think architectural ideas are, you know, because they have to gain traction with lots of different people, can be made use of in different ways.
Yeah.
I do think Brett's horror at what had happened, even though it was essentially what he asked, is, he says we prefer the slums. It's the lack of planning in somewhere like Worcester that's the problem. That development is in the wrong place.
Mm.
And so I am sympathetic to the idea. But that's what happens.
Yeah. No. Bring to a close. But in terms of, I'm always reluctant to ask these sort of the question, but it says the legacy of the 1960s for the 2020 or 2020s, as it were, or, you know, current day. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah.
You can see lots of similarities and lots of contextual resonance from there, the issues that they're grappling with. You know, Blackburn in the 1960s worried about brain drain. They're still worried about that today. A kind of retail-led response to a restructuring process, you know, essentially making, you know, city centres mono-use rather than, you know, multi-use. That's a problem we're now trying to address through the current future of the high street kind of debate. I still think, you make this point in the book brilliantly, the dominance of the private car and the car particularly to the detriment of other forms of transport, and not just public, but also walking and cycling, you know, all of those sorts of things. We're trying to, you know, that's where the agenda is. Much of that was evident, either central or at the edges of the discussion in the 1960s.
Yeah. I suppose, one of the things I'm pleased about with this book is it looks at types of cities which don't get looked at.
Yeah.
I think these are places that, you know, need to be celebrated.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of lots of what happened in the 60s. I think it was. I don't think there are necessarily lessons to, and especially with the car. You know, although actually we keep on making the same mistakes. And money is important, you know, and I think, you know, if you to make a nice environment is needed.
Well, I was going to say, on the dominance of, there are lots of fantastic facts, stats in the book, which is definitely well worth a read. The one towards the end of the book, where you talk about essentially the ignoring of any other, you know, pretty much any other form of transport, particularly the downplay of, you know, the significance of biking and cycling, you know, which seems to be a kind of very modern phenomenon, but actually, and the stat you know says there was a survey of six towns near London in 1957. 35% of the journeys to work were by bicycle, while even in the new town of Crawley, where no provision for cycling had been made, 25% of the journeys were made to work were made by that means. So in 1957, 25% of the journeys were made to work on a bike. The number today, or at least in 2011, according to the census, which you can get on our website, is 2.5% of journeys are now made, and that's probably gone up, you know, so it probably went even lower than 2.5%. It's a kind of amazing sort of, you know, how these things evolve and, you know, work out.
Well, I think cycling is an example of one of the things that is a real failure of the whole political culture, and especially the planning culture of the 1960s, that the presumption that everybody would share in affluence meant that problems of poverty were ignored. Mm. Buchanan is just extraordinary about this. He mentions techno gizmos like hovercrafts and jetpacks as possible alternatives to the car. But there's one sentence in the whole book about cycling which I think says something like, he says, you know, we could have cycle tracks, but this is probably too expensive and impracticable. This is someone who is suggesting the entire rebuilding of Oxford Street on multiple levels for
but
the
not
car.
To spend too much on
but not to spend too much on cycling. I the plan for Coventry, I was seeing in 66, gets rid of their you know, huge number of cycle tracks which were originally there. I think one of the things we haven't mentioned about the car is how much it was. Britain in the 1950s was the biggest exporter of cars in the world, and that's a big side of why they can't see this. But it is what I don't like. You know, in the later 60s there's a rediscovery of poverty, and a realization that actually the physical aspects of this huge rebuilding of Britain has helped some people, but has really exacerbated the position of others.
Yeah, well, I think the book does many things, but as you know, it's an excellent reminder that very modern issues and challenges often have deep roots in history. Today, my guest has been Otto Samaras Smith. Otto, thank you very much for being part of City.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.